Welcome to TrueDemocracy.Global podcast. We are joined once again by Saeed Hamzavi. In the past episodes, he has come to us as an expert on getting a drug approved by the FDA as a chemist with Genentech Roche. Today, however, he's here as someone with similar interests to this podcast, namely health from a more holistic perspective and ancient civilizations. We talked about Mesopotamia. We'll talk about those subjects. And here we are, just two guys talking. The TrueDemocracy.Global podcast, where we are looking into systems of democracy, the technologies that support them, as well as various systems of authority. Our hope is that through understanding and applying shared knowledge and evolving technology, that we can find ways to build trust and encourage constructive collaboration, which may bring about greater freedom for humanity and a true democracy where the power stems truly from the people. And everyone has a voice in collaboration with their fellow humans, men and women of any background. We live in an unprecedented time in history with technologies that have never before existed that may help bring about this vision. Saeed, how are you?
Hey, I'm very well, thank you, and hope you're doing well.
Thank you for joining me again on a different topic this time. Well, not what your career's in, as far as a chemist for Genentech Roche and getting drugs approved by the FDA, which is a very fascinating subject, but we discovered some similar topics that we have an interest in particular interest to this podcast, health and ancient civilizations. Health is ultimately, I think, the ultimate goal with the vision of TrueDemocracy.Global is to create a society where we can live lives of healthy lives and well-being. And I think the freedom that democracy brings can help bring that about as well. You know, also ancient civilizations, Mesopotamia. I'm always been fascinated in how social structures have changed over the years, particularly in relation to technologies, writing technologies, and how those social structures have affected our ability to live a free life and a healthy life. So it's all connected, as you know.
No question about that.
So in the last episode, you were talking about diet as a huge factor in health, particularly sugar. Do you want to say a little bit about that, just as a reminder?
Well, as you know, first of all, thanks again for the invitation and the opportunity to join your podcast and talk to your listeners as well. As far as, you know, health and health is concerned, I have been studying the what we consume as consumers, food, and the industry that is involved with it, and the health of the society and the rampant different diseases that everybody, especially in the industrial world, are encountering. There, we are finding a very tight and close relationship with what we are consuming as food. And when you look at it from what our ancestors, hunter-gatherers used to eat and survive on, we have moved so much away from that, which is essentially moving away from the nature, the way nature nurtures us. And we work with nature. So we have been moving away farther and farther from the nature as far as in many aspects of our lives, but very vivid aspect of it is food, which we have to consume every day in for our survival. And when you look at the way, the trend that we have, despite all the advancement in the medicine, the lifespan of human has from 40 years that it used to be on the average, now we are going to about 70 years, 80 years. But everybody has certain amount of number of ailments throughout their age, especially as they progress towards the a later part of their lives. And when you look at the way nature works, really, we should not, it shouldn't be the age that is really causing all of these ailments and sicknesses and diseases that we are encountering. And when you look at it closely, you find out the cause of that is the relationship that we have with the food and how we get our food and from the nature. Yeah, of course, we get it from the nature, but we put and manipulate it tremendously. We manipulate everything in the farm, the soil, herbicides, pesticides that we put in the ground, and we destroy so many beneficial bacteria in the soil that we have to have in order to have the plant that we are growing to have all the nutrients in there. And by adding all these chemicals, we first of all interrupting those ecosystem that exist between the plants and the nature. And as a result, first of all, we are not having all the nutrients that should be in there. Second of all, we are adding all these pesticides and herbicides in there that we end up consuming part of it because we cannot get rid of all of that. The plant absorbed that, and it is on the surface of the plant. And we end up eating them, and the animals that we eat, we feed them with the same thing. We treat the animal very, not only not humanely, especially the commercial, but we inject them with a lot of antibiotic, a lot of growth hormones, and so these animals, and feed them with the wrong stuff. You know, cow, they are not, herbivores are supposed to be eating vegetable, green things, not corn. And when you do that to these animals, essentially we change the chemistry of their and biology of their body. And for example, when you eat, when you feed the cow with corn, what happens is the amount of omega-6, which is an inflammatory chemical, fat, essentially it is a fat that is in the meat that we eat because of the corn that they have been fed with, it causes all kinds of inflammation in our bodies and immune problem that as a result of that it is causing. So when you think about it, when you look at it very closely, this is one part of it. Then the food that eventually is taken out of the farm comes to these companies, that food companies that process the material that we, the crop that we got from the land to death, take all the nutrients out of it, and then start putting additive for what it lost. And all of those are synthetic material, vitamins, minerals, and so on and so forth. And example of it, I guess I mentioned last time, when you go to a supermarket, you look at the shelves, they're packed with numerous number of food material in can, in boxes, in paper containers, and they last forever. They never essentially expire. Yeah, there is an expiration date on them. But food is not supposed to last more than a few days, up to a week, depending on what it is. While they sit there for months and they don't rot, they don't go bad, and we end up eating all of those preservatives that have been put in there.
Do you know anything about when a food is stamped as organic, how accurate that is? Or for the example, cows, or if they're free range or grass fed, do you know the actual meaning behind those things?
I have not really studied that. I have listened and read a lot about these. Our best resort is those that there's a stamp by government. Actually, they are supposed to comply with a lot of requirements. And so the question is, how closely are they monitored? I'm hoping that is the case.
Yeah.
And that is, I have become a major consumer of the organic food and vegetable and anything that is coming out of the are in the supermarket shelves. And that is my only hope that, yes, those regulations that have been put in place, they are truly being implemented and followed and monitored properly.
Yeah. And then also if how it's defined, it's one thing to monitor it closely, but also is the definition really close to what is actually healthy for us and humanity? So.
Well, at least I am assuming that when we are talking organic, at least they are not, no pesticide has been used on them.
Yeah.
Or herbicide have been used on them. So that is one area which I think gives you a little hope that you are not taking additional toxins into your
toxins. Yeah. I don't know those details either. So anyway, but just to relate this to another topic, which I wanted to talk about, ancient Mesopotamia, which I recently did this lecture series, the Great Signature Course, Great Lectures, or something like that. It's a Amazon Prime, which is a really amazing resource, which are actual lectures from college professors. This one was 24 lectures, half an hour each.
Wow.
Amanda Padami, I'm sorry, I'm definitely butchering her name, but I didn't go back and get the correct pronunciation, but she studied ancient Mesopotamia. But I want to talk about that more later, but I want to bring it up now because she mentioned that as soon as the ancient Mesopotamians, which they weren't really called that at the time, started farming, there was evidence that their health declined as well, as far as the bone structure that they were finding. So what you're saying is true in that case as well, but it goes back 10,000 years.
That
as soon as we went from hunter-gatherers to farmers, we started altering the food immediately. It's been going on that long.
I totally agree. When we start meddling with how nature does its job, we are going to inadvertently impact the outcome and the fruit that you get out of our manipulation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, what you are doing is something that nature was not designed for it, to the same extent. Seasons that they had to, of course, manipulate the soil, they had to manipulate the find the seeds and harvest them. And again, typically you have to have one somehow to provide the nutrient in the soil that make the plant that you are harvesting has all the requirement, all the nutrient that it has to have to be in there. And when you keep doing it, you deplete the soil from those nutrients.
Right,
and as you do and frequently use it more and more, obviously depletion of the nutrient from the soil is going to be impacting the quality of the food that you're going to be consuming. And of course, this was passed. They did not have the technology that we have to put fertilizer in there. But fertilizer really does, only thing it provides is nitrogen.
Oh, okay.
Which is essential, but there's a lot of other nutrients, minerals that are required that fertilizer does not provide. So then I'm sure, there were natural fertilizers. I can imagine the human being has learned to, put natural fertilizers like animals, excrement and so forth, which was good. But again, that was mainly the source of that was nitrogen. And of course, nitrogen is an essential part of cell making and for the plants, but that's not totally enough. As a result, again, the food that you end up consuming is going to be missing a lot of entities that nature usually puts it in there.
Right. I don't know if we could ever get back to a day and age where we're in complete union with nature. But
I don't. Yeah, considering the population that we have, there is no way that we are going to be in a hydroponic, I guess they call it nowadays, you know, with water, essentially put the nutrients in water and the roots are in the water. God forbid, imagine what that is going to turn out.
So, in summary, we're living longer because of our technology, but not healthier.
Not healthier, you know, completely. I mean, when you know, there are five zones, green zones, they call them, or blue zones. Blue zones that they call them. And they have looked at those different zones in around the world. One of them is in Greece, one of them is in Japan, and one of them is actually in part of California. And I have to think of the other two countries they have looked at how these people live. I mean, they live over 100 almost on the average age of people in those small villages. These are small villages that these people on the average, you know, they have kids which are in their 80s and the grandparents who are in their 100, and it is amazing. They have gone and looked at what is the habit of these people, how do they live so long, and why they're so healthy. And they find that pretty much they have kept the that connection with the nature very closely. They do farm every day. They go out and use the nature. They don't eat a lot of meat. They most of their diet is vegetables and occasionally fish. And, you know, maybe a couple of times a month they eat meat. And so they are very active. You know, it doesn't matter how old they are. Even at 80s, they work very hard. You know, they're farmers.
Yeah.
Get up early in the morning, go to the farm, and work arduous work. And but when they come back, another aspect of the healthy aspect of how they do it is they are very interconnected. They live together. They have lots of what we call parties. Essentially, they eat together, and they keep a very close tie with the neighbors, with the whole community, and they're never alone. And this is one factor that has been identified, that relationship is very essential to our health and our longevity.
Okay, relationship, that's another aspect of it.
Very much so, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they say if you have five friends that you can count on any moment, any problem that you have, and you can do call them up and they drop everything to help you out with your problem, you're going to live practically over 100 years. And by every number that you drop, your age drops by 20%.
Oh. Interesting. Yeah. Is that a study or?
This is what they are statistically coming down to, that the more close friendship and relationship you have, the healthier you're going to be and you live longer.
Do you know the process by which that works on our body?
Well, I don't know if you remember the speech I gave a couple of weeks or 3 weeks ago. And there is one thing that, you know, our genes, every time the cell replicates itself, the chromosome has, at the end of each chromosome, there is a chemical that it keeps breaking down every time, and it gets smaller. You know, essentially, it is like, you know, you have seen the shoelace. At the end of the shoelace, there is a solid piece that holds the shoelace together. Mm-hmm. So this piece keeps getting shorter and shorter and shorter every time the cell replicates itself. It gets to a point that after so many replications, millions of replications, it gets so short that the cell cannot reproduce anymore.
Oh.
And that is when essentially the cell dies. And usually when the cell dies, we die.
Oh, you know, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And when you are in a community and it is found that if you do philanthropic activities, mm-hmm. the more you do philanthropic activities, actually you live longer. This is what the scientists have identified. The more you help others, the longer you live.
Is this connected to the cell replication?
Exactly. So what they found out is that those entities at the end of the chromosome, actually by your good deed, they start to grow longer.
Oh, okay. They
physically start growing longer and extend and lengthens. And as a result, they add to your life. This is how nature has been designed, essentially, that wants you to be more of a helper to mm-hmm. your other fellow human. And so when these people are living together, first of all, they're enjoying the company of each other. They're continuously helping each other. They're not like, this is my home. Everything is mine. I have to take care of only my own and my family. They do that for the rest of the community. It's not only neighbor. They keep lending hand to the community mm-hmm. and they work collaboratively with each other. So that's another reason that, you know, it has been identified that it helps you to live long. I can give you, I went to a conference and it was not at the conference. It was at Genentech, which actually this gentleman who had been going around the world and looking at these blue zones,
uh-huh.
he gave us a story that this guy was in Philadelphia and he was about 50 years of age and he had his doctors told him that you have lung cancer and you don't have more than 6 months or a year. And so what this guy, he was, his parents, grandparents, they had migrated from Greece. And it happened that his grandparents belonged to that village in Greece.
Uh-huh.
And they lived forever, practically speaking. So he decided, okay, if I'm going to live so short, this is all I have, at least let me enjoy my life. He sells everything that he had, and he moves out, goes to that village.
Still thinking that he was going to die in 6 months.
Yeah, at least yeah. he says, I'm going to, you know, live with my grandparents, relatives, to somewhere mm-hmm. that I can enjoy my life. And no matter how short it is, at least I don't have to suffer here and wait for my death. And he leaves and he goes back, goes to that part of Greece, that small island. And now this guy lived more than 90 years. And the gentleman wow. who was giving the story, he said, of course, we know he lived that many years because he communicated, he was able to communicate with him continuously to see how it is. And he's happily living there and he's still living.
Mm-hmm.
So think about that.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing story. And just to be fair, it's one story.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we could find stories where somebody did that and it didn't have that same effect and then what the difference would be. So just to be a little more scientific about it.
Yeah, well, of course, as I said, you know, these people are going around the world and looking yeah. at these societies, communities, five of them that are existing. And the average life is over 100.
And one's in California, huh?
Yeah, somewhere it is in California, not, small town in California.
Not Benicia?
No. Oh. It is, yeah, I guess, around our desert, you okay. know, close to LA, somewhere there. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting because what I picture for society is going back to more community living, eventually evolving back to that. as much as possible. Like I said, I don't know if we'd get back to the 100% in sync with nature living of hunting, gathering, but definitely living more from the land and as pure as possible and in community. And that's what I envision, that something like TrueDemocracy.global and a voting platform can help bring about, because it gives the community's actual power over. I wonder if there's some structure in those communities, that how they're run and how they're organized. That would be something interesting to look into.
Yeah, I guess it would be, I don't know. I'm interested myself to take a look and see. I'm sure we can find more information about these communities on the internet.
Yeah.
To see how they live actually, and what is the structure that they have. But what I can see is, you know, it just reminds me of my old, when I was young back home, things were not as mechanized as these days. And I remember there was it, first of all, you know, people, you know, Persian community are very social. Mm-hmm. And we enjoy getting together all the time, you know, having parties, spend time with each other. And back home, I remember it was impossible. Every weekend, we were either had a few guests for the day, or we were guests at somebody or one of their other relatives. And there was no exception. We had to have this community, and people about 10 o'clock at night knock on your door, you know, just to say hello, have a cup of tea with you. And you are not surprised. I mean, you cannot do that here. I mean, I would be pretty much very annoyed if somebody did that to me now here. Mm-hmm. But back home, that was not very unusual, that people would knock on the door 10 o'clock at night. I just wanted to say hello, see how you're doing, and sit with you for a few hours, you know, an hour turns in. 3 hours just to have a little chat and finding out how things are going. And so these are, you know, the more industrial life has become, the more mechanized life has turned into, and we are more isolated, and even from ourselves, you know.
Right.
When we are talking about isolating ourselves from the nature, mechanized the society is, we are isolating ourselves from each other also.
I'm also curious about, which I doubt you'll have the answer to, it's just something to ponder, is the difference between like an extroverted personality, introverted personality, where, you know, the social lifestyle is supposedly a little more stressful for the introverted personality. And if there's a difference between how an introverted personality might live more healthier, more happy, isolated, or less social, I should say. Yeah.
I mean, if I have to conclude, if I have to conclude based on what we are seeing, you need contact.
You definitely need contact, but
you need contact, and not just contact. You need contact which is meaningful, you know, that you can relate with the person you are having a communication with, that you can tell your inner concerns and hear their inner concerns and exchange that and listen to each other. And so when I say contact, really, I mean, I'm sure even social contact at work, those are having positive impact because they change your environment, the way you think about everything else. And during these pandemic, almost 2 years that we have had, if we did not have the Zoom, I've been working from home. If we did not have the Zoom to constantly communicate with my colleagues, it would have been very unbearable.
Yeah.
For me. It would have been very unbearable. Of course, because there were so many of them, I would be getting exhausted like everybody else in my team that we were working because of the number of meetings that we had. But So at the end of the day, you would be so exhausted that you would be happy that, yeah, it is end of it. No more of it. I don't need any more of it. But if you didn't have those, I think it would be very unbearable for me. Mm. And I'm sure it would be the same thing for everybody. Because you need to have that contact and relationship, no matter how far it is. Just like you and I are having a conversation. We have a relationship right now with each other. Mm-hmm. We are communicating, we are exchanging. And I think that is meaningful.
Yeah, I think the key is meaningful.
Absolutely. When you're telling me something, I'm receptive to that. I try to digest it and I try to understand what are your message is trying to be conveyed to me, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So when you're doing that, you're not just two passerbys that they pass each other and say hi and bye. That's very different.
Yeah, or doing something that's I don't know. I can't think of an example less meaningful. Loud parties or something like that.
I to be honest with you, especially when I was in college, I used to go to a lot of these cake parties. Mm-hmm. that the especially undergrad.
Did you say cake or keg?
Cake. Cake, I didn't mind. it was just going there and drinking and chatting nonsense without really anything getting anything out of that. So that one, I never enjoyed them. Mm-hmm. Very honestly, I never enjoyed it. And to me, when you go to a party, you want to have a few good friends that you have in that party that you can talk with, find out how they are doing. They want to know how you are doing and talk about everything and enjoy each other's company. Nice, and that is what is a meaningful relationship to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that picture.
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked about food related to health, relationships. What about, I'm especially interested in your view on this from a chemist's point of view, stress.
Yeah, well, stress is enemy of our health, no question about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, stress, of course, is, as you know, our amygdala is responsible for keeping us safe. You know, hundreds of years ago, I mean, thousands of years ago, the mankind was just like the rest of the animal kingdom, that we were food for the, bigger animals. That was a protective mechanism for us. So in order to survive, so what happens, adrenaline, as soon as, your mind, you sense danger, adrenaline, a stress hormone, start getting released. And what it does, the stress hormone, its job is to pretty much stop everything, your digestion, reproduction, cell reproduction, everything. And the only thing it is going to do, it is going to constrain blood to your gut, to your brain, and everything else except your muscles. So you can either fight the enemy or run away. So that is the function of it. This is a function for our survivability that nature has given us. Now, the problem is that has stayed with us, and there is no tiger to go after us, but a deadline. It's like that. We react to a deadline like that. We want to give a speech. We react the same way. You're in the traffic. We have the same reaction. So the problem is this has become continuous. Mm-hmm. Continuous. This hormone is flooding our blood, and it is very detrimental to us when it is short term. Yeah, it goes away. But when it is long-term, continuous, on a daily basis, it tears our body apart. And that is why a lot of diseases are being caused because of stress.
Mm-hmm.
And again, stress is a result of, again, the mechanistic lifestyle that industrial world has imposed on its population.
Right.
That everything is deadline-oriented, pressure, and meeting everything on time, and so forth. And as a result, we are under constant stress.
Right.
And that's not healthy.
I imagine
no question it is not healthy for
there's
us.
There's two kinds of continuous stress. One is that it just keeps happening over and over again, imagined or deadlines that we are constantly facing over and over again. And the other is are things that we don't resolve.
Exactly. Yeah.
So some issue that happens and we don't resolve it. So we are thinking about it constantly.
Yeah. It is not there, but we just make it.
Chemically, do you know what's going on?
Again, this is what I explained. You know, your body essentially constrains your body does not, the cells don't reproduce.
Okay.
They stop reproducing.
It's related to that.
Your digestion is interrupted.
Stops digestion.
Your blood doesn't, not much blood goes into your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it is limitation of nutrients and, opposite of that is happiness, calm. When you're in a calm mood, it is, that's when the cells start to reproduce. Your digestion is very normal. Then when you have a proper digestive system, your body gets all the nutrients that you need. And then obviously you're going to be healthy because your body is getting all the nutrients and you're happy, and your cells are happy. And as a result, you are happy. But when you don't have those, when you have those restrictions, all of these are limitation for us. And when it is long-term, you don't get enough nutrient into your system. You are not having a very productive mind. And it impacts everything. Your heart, your liver, your kidneys, your pancreas, name it. Every cell in your body is going to be adversely impacted. And that causes the diseases we end up having.
Wow, yeah.
And the major part is it kills essentially the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those impacts that it has, this stress hormone has, cortisol has on you, is it weakens the immune system. So that's why you're susceptible to getting sick now.
How does
bacteria and viruses?
How does it kill the immune system?
It doesn't kill it. It reduces its effectiveness.
Oh, I see. It doesn't kill.
When I said I'm just exaggerating.
Yeah,
Your immune system. Suppresses your immune system. Yeah, that's the proper.
Like it's doing with the digestion and
for digestion, yeah, everything. Yeah. Because the only thing is important for that time is your muscles. And nothing but muscles. So they can run and your lung. So you can breathe and your heart. So you can, pump the blood through your muscles and get you away from the threat or start fighting back.
Mm-hmm. So this is related to my ongoing theory about hierarchies and their relation to health, is that we start to live from the rules of an external authority. So in, government structure, corporate structure, people that we're trying to work for and telling us what to do and imposing the deadlines upon us, et cetera, trying to get everything done now, right away, as soon as possible, competition, with other companies, trying to get the work done.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. You are there. You are just said it. That is what artificially is being imposed on us by our employer, by our you know, government system that we have. You go, you're driving, you cross the red light and you see the siren of the police car, your blood pressure jumps 200%, and all of these are negative and unnecessary and just false alarms for our system that, you know, we are carrying this amygdala with us. And of course, as I say, it is important for our survivability that we have to have it.
It's not something we could have surgically removed and then be happy.
You cannot do that. I mean, you can do that. If you do that, then you're not going to be afraid of anything.
Yeah.
You know, you run into a snake.
Yeah.
Snake, you're not going to be afraid. You're going to go to it. It's going to bite you and it's going to kill you. Or a car is coming, you're not going to respond to it. You're not afraid of that.
Okay.
So that, those are the mechanisms that are there for protection, for protecting us.
All right. So this ongoing theory of mine about the evolution of writing technology and the social structure, my theory had been that as writing developed, we developed hierarchies. That these hierarchies were then needed because writing was an elite task, an elite skill. Only a few people had it. We couldn't mass produce laws or any form of writing to distribute to the people. So these hierarchies developed to distribute the rules of society. And this led into my interest in studying ancient Mesopotamia and other cultures too, which I haven't got to yet. But Mesopotamia was first because, well,
that's the oldest.
The oldest. And so I watched these lectures, the great signature course, Ancient Mesopotamia, Life in the Cradle of Civilization, Amanda Podamy, Podany. From California State Polytech University in Pomona. So she was a historian that studied this. And the unique thing about that culture that we have so much information about is because they wrote on clay tablets.
True.
This cuneiform writing on clay tablets, which survives,
exactly.
Whereas Egypt, Greek, and Roman cultures wrote on papyrus, which disappears and disintegrates. So there's a lot of information on this ancient civilization, even though it's not as popular as Egypt, Greece, or Roman Empire, where in United States probably.
And that's what makes me wonder.
Yeah,
actually,
why
it is not, you know, as looked upon or popularized, because this is where all of us came from,
right? Well,
our culture, our civilization, all of that came from there. And how are we totally ignoring that? Yeah, I mean, very limited number of people, historians, would know about it, but you do not hear about it. They don't teach you in the school, elementary school, middle school, high school. You don't hear any of that.
What about in Iran?
In Iran, that's where I learned a lot of this. You know, history was very important.
Was it taught in Iran?
Yes, very heavily. I mean, I remember we had very colorful history books. Huge, big books. I loved it. And in order to make it attractive to the students, they would put tons of picture in there.
Okay.
Colorful. That's why I loved it. I would just for the pictures, I would go turn the pages. Of course, then we had to memorize it because of the school curriculum that it was in order to pass. So it was very heavily taught.
Was Greek, Roman, Egyptian culture taught as well?
Briefly, yes.
It's
mostly because of the interactions that we had with them. Alexander, who invaded Iran, and then Iran before that Persian invaded Greece, and then he revenged came back and took over. So those were all, you know, discussed. The Roman Empire was, the Egyptian history was discussed, because these were big cultures and at the time, and so which impacted everybody's life presently.
So anyway, back to my point or my discovery about this connection between writing and hierarchies is it didn't seem to be, there's not a strong correlation, at least in Mesopotamia. And writing, there was evidence of civilization long before writing. And after writing, there was no evidence of written law for a long time, and no evidence of hierarchies for a long time. So the society seemed to be operating without written law, and also without the hierarchies. The hierarchies seemed to evolve out of the need to trade. Not necessarily related to rules, that a lot of these early writings were all administrative, you know, trading goods and et cetera. So there were hierarchies that were evolved along the need to trade goods, not necessarily government structures. But still, you know, the hierarchies create the external authority situation. And there's thousands of years before of civilization without the recognition of a leader, a ruler. There wasn't a king until, I think,
tribal. They were tribal.
It was more than tribal, because there were big societies that existed. Let me see. The first writing was more like memory aids. It was basically like a drawing of a cow and a number next to it, meaning, you know, probably we are trading these many cows. And then it evolved to describe more complex words by using symbols that were similar to the syllables. And still no kings. 3000 BCE is around 2500 that there was evidence of any single ruler, which was 400 years after writing. Is that right? 2900 was the first evidence of a king.
2900 before Christ, which is about 5,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's what my recollection is, that about 5,000 years ago or so, that's when writing started. And because of the structure of the system, because what my understanding was that the rulers wanted to have a law that was applied everywhere, and people would not deviate from those laws. Those rulers, local rulers, would not be deviating. So they had to write these laws in writing. And that's essentially, that's what it became a little more rampant and more utilized and more advanced.
Yeah, but it still wasn't. The first laws were around 2100 BCE, and they weren't really laws. So there was a lot of social structure even before that, at least written laws. They had court systems. They had court systems that, you know, decided cases and probably used precedents from previous court cases, but they still weren't written as laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now you talked earlier about 2900 to 1 Kings. And almost 800 years before there is any sign of written laws in that time.
Okay. You're talking about when? Roughly how long ago?
2100 BCE.
2100.
Yeah.
4000. 4000 years.
And the first written laws, she said, were related to court cases. So they were bringing, taking precedences from previous court cases and kind of laying it out is, you know, this is what happens when you do this activity, you know, this would happen. And it wasn't very complete either. It was kind of loosely written.
Yeah. Well, considering, you know, 4,000 years ago,
yeah,
there's no writing capabilities. I mean, when you think about it, people had to invent letters and words. I mean, they were talking, of course.
Yeah.
But also, they were talking different dialects and languages because these people were all over the place at that time. And so they were speaking different languages. So we can imagine for the rulers, it would not have been very easy to come up with the writing system that everybody would understand. So challenge was high.
Yeah. Well, the cuneiform writing apparently was could be used for different languages because it was a syllabic based on syllables. They could use it for any different language or many different languages. That's why it lasted even, so long.
Yeah, still, you know, it is a lot. It takes a lot of intelligence to come up with that.
And a lot of time too, thousands and thousands of years it evolved. Yeah. And we look at this in the vast amount of time that this society thrived. It was more amount of time that has passed since it dissolved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It lasted for 3,000 years.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been around for only 2,000 years. So.
Yeah,
a vast amount of time. And look at what we've done since then.
Yeah. Well, I learned something very interesting. Now we are in the same line. Maybe it might be a little bit different divergence from your topic. But because we're talking about language, you know, scientists have identified that language was invented by human just because we think. Because we wanted to express what we are thinking.
Mm.
You know, because just sit quiet and you're thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you are thinking in your own language. A Japanese thinks in his own language. A Portuguese thinks in his own language. Mm-hmm. So human, essentially, they started inventing language to express what they were thinking. Because thought had been in our head from day one, but no language. Yeah, we might have been able to utter certain voices that we were hearing from environment, but nothing really meaningful.
The thought before language would have had to been more in pictures and images of what we see in here.
Well, of course, I can imagine that they were limited to what they were experiencing.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, whatever they were experiencing, you know. But again, there's a lot of common thing. You have your cold. You're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
You have a pain. All of those, this would be common, right? So all of us, no matter where we are, we have that thought that we have a sensation out of it and somehow we want to express it. And that's why language was essentially invented by humans because of the thought that they wanted to express.
Mm-hmm.
form of communication.
It's a social tool.
Exactly. They couldn't communicate what was going in their head.
Yeah.
So they had to find a way to communicate that. So that's where language was.
Language would have been one of the very first communication technologies then, not writing. Yeah. If you call it that, technology.
I would actually, I feel probably writing would be first one, because it is easier to draw an animal.
Oh, okay.
You know, you see plant, animals.
Right, right.
It's far easier at that time. You know, you say, oh, you want to show it. This is a giraffe.
Mm-hmm.
Long neck and so forth. Until then you develop something to reflect that.
But in order to draw, it requires the use of tools.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
These are all
interconnected, no question.
Yeah.
And sequential, of course.
Tools, language, drawing, writing. Well, obviously writing had to come after language. Writing, not drawing.
Well, I mean, for them it would have been writing. I mean, that was the start of writing.
Yeah.
Drawing. That was the language. I mean, just like hieroglyphic is a lot of are symbolic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that was even after the cuneiform writing of Mesopotamia.
Right.
Yeah, it's just interesting. I mean, and somewhere along the line, we define a time where we separate from nature. You know, is that when we started using tools? Is it when we started to use language or writing or farming? You know, all these are just
all of above.
Yeah.
I would say all of above. Everything that we had to become a little protected from the nature. If you built a house, that was unusual, right?
Yeah. Instead
protect yourself against, you know, the rain and cold and heat and so forth. If you made it yourself, then it is a little deviation. I mean, animals, what do? They go hide in a hole.
Some of them dig holes.
Some of them dig holes, right. They're a little more intelligent, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, somewhere there's a line where it's nature and it's not.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's all nature because we created.
We are
our brains evolved in nature.
Yeah.
So anyway. All very fascinating.
Absolutely. I mean, I always cannot stop thinking about all these events that evolving that we have gone through.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes you wonder. I was listening to, again, another segue. I was listening to an atheist and a rabbi or a priest that they were arguing existence of God, and I can see both of them have a strong logic, but sometimes I myself, you know, as a scientist, I have to look at everything based on science and facts.
Uh-huh.
There are intricacies that we see in nature. Sometimes it baffles you that if there is intelligence that was responsible for it.
Yeah. Well, there's some theories of evolution that lean that way.
Yeah. There's no question about that. It's very fun. That's why I say this is very fascinating. It's always mind-boggling, and I always love to dig into it, explore these, mm-hmm. and learn as much as I can.
There's something you said last time also about that you believe will eventually evolve into, I can't remember the exact wording, but.
Yeah, my belief is, you know, we are right now still essentially primitive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have evolved tremendous distance from when we were apes and to the point that we are so intelligent that we can go to the other planets and predict what is going to happen in the future and look at inside ourselves and the intricate mechanism that is working in there. We are deciphering all of that. So it is huge advancement in those regards, knowing ourselves. But so these are physical, in terms of physical aspect of our existence, that I see that we have made huge amount of advancement. But from mental, we have a long way to go. And but again, we have evolved from that perspective as well. I mean, our frontal lobe has really has been the reason for all the advancement that we have been making, contrary to the apes and other animals who do not have the frontal lobe. And the logic, essentially, this is where all our logics come from. And it has been growing and growing. And so right now, we are finding ourselves to be very dependent physically. Dependent, and as a result, are very greedy about our needs.
Greedy, that was what you were talking about
right,
from
the greed.
Yeah,
it is the greed that is the source of a lot of our problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have, I don't know, an income of $100,000 versus somebody who has income of millions of dollars every month. I mean, both of us need the same amount of, essentially, amount of food and a house to protect you from the elements and, you know, future and so forth to be predictable for you. So you don't need that vast amount and almost unimaginable amount of wealth to survive.
It's pretty simple, actually.
Yeah, when you think about it, we are very simple creatures, but our greed makes us totally separate from that thought and reality.
There's greed, but there's also creativity or in expanding knowledge and wanting to learn more that takes a lot of resources.
Learning, I have no issue with that one, but we have to keep working at it. But as long as you are not stepping on somebody else's food in order to gain that additional knowledge, I mean, you want to learn, great, go and learn, but you don't want to take something away from somebody else. This is what I call greed.
And that's the opposite of philanthropy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. The giving that you talked about, that extends lives.
Yes. It is absolutely, you're absolutely right. It is totally against the philanthropy. And Bruce Lipton, who is a scientist, he calls that, you know, right now the corporations are like dinosaurs. Very small brain and huge.
Mm.
And that is what caused them to go extinct. And that is because of that greed. Essentially, the principle is what we're talking about. It is greed that we are creating these dinosaurs, that they want to take over everything. They want everything before them, regardless of how much damage they have on their nature, on the others' lives, and so forth. So eventually, you get so big that you cannot, your organs cannot sustain you and hold you.
Yeah, there's got
to
be
a
size limit.
And you collapse.
Dinosaurs, though, they got wiped out by an asteroid.
Sure, yeah. Sure. But what he's saying, because if they were smart, they would have survived in a different way. Because, see, we as humans, you know, we have gone through five major extinctions, mm-hmm. and we are considering ourselves to be the sixth one.
Yeah, we can create data.
We human are going to be causing.
But the Earth is going to survive.
Oh, Earth always survives. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Earth has does not, nature does not care. I mean, Earth has been out there for 4.5 billion years. It's very patient.
Yeah.
Everything that happened to it, it started again in a different form or shape. I mean, of course, if dinosaurs had not been extinct, we would not be here.
Exactly. If that asteroid didn't hit.
No, we would not be here. I mean, essentially, asteroid cleared the Earth for the small mammals, including humans.
Well, we might be clearing the Earth for somebody else.
Yeah, unfortunately, we might. I hope. And my hope to look at it in a positive perspective is you need always to be positive,
right.
Is to believe that the outcome, we are smart enough that eventually we prevent ourselves from doing that.
I tend to think that too. I think that, you know, the evolution is, I believe that there's intelligence behind it, a greater intelligence than just us that wants to see it turn out. But
I mean, even if there is no intelligence behind it, I mean, time, you know, as I said, nature is very patient,
mm-hmm.
and it has unlimited amount of time. So, you know, Earth has lived for 4.5 billion years. Human beings have been on the Earth for 200,000 years.
It's a small, small world.
It is not even conceivable for that period of time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, dinosaurs lived on Earth for 300 million years. Think about it.
I know.
300 million years. That's a lot of time.
Yeah. And they were in harmony with it too.
They were in harmony, very
apparently.
Much, because they were part of nature. Yeah.
Yeah. And who knows? Who knows how it would have evolved if the asteroid didn't hit?
Well, again, I mean, they kept, you know, growing like that. And of course, others, you know, we had Ice Age, of course.
Mm-hmm. Several.
We have had several Ice Ages, but probably it would have destroyed a part of it, but not they would not have gone extinct.
Yeah.
If they had grown, we would not be here to talk about things like that.
So getting back and to tie this back in to communication and evolution of technology, and you talked about the blue zones, that people are in community and relationship and philanthropy. And now we're in this sort of hierarchical society, separation and greed.
Yeah.
So this is the whole point of what I'm seeing or hoping is going on with the evolving technology and blockchain, is that it can take away the need for the external authorities, the hierarchies, and allow communities to govern themselves, and communities of communities to govern themselves, and communities of communities of communities to govern themselves, and get back to more of that natural living. That if philanthropy helps us live longer, I would imagine we would naturally steer towards that if given the social structures to create it.
Yeah, actually, you know, what you're saying is very true, because, you know, if we get to the point that this greed doesn't exist anymore, it is not a point for us, a requirement for us, philanthropy would become essentially a given fact. Because if you have even-handedness there and your goal is something much higher, none of these are going to become the hindrance for you, and you want to do it in harmony with everybody, all together. And so it is going to become an integral part of essentially an integral part of that kind of community that it doesn't require greed and competition of this nature.
Mm-hmm.
A negative competition, I call it.
Because, you know, positive competition, it helps us grow.
Exactly. Yeah.
And to bring, I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, anyway. Blockchain essentially bring us to that point. And I agree with you. If there is we get to a point that, and a system that help us out to get to a point that these, what we call greed is not going to become an issue as a concern, definitely everybody is happy with what they have. Mm-hmm. It is not social life. I mean, we are not talking about social life. Again, I'm not talking more materialistic thing. I'm talking more mental aspect
of
thoughts and expectation of about ourselves and our future and where we want to go and where we want to be advancing to. In order to go there, we really need to be at that level to succeed. We cannot, you know, these what we have as agreed is a big chain on our feet at hands that is holding us down right now, mm-hmm. slowing that progress, mm-hmm. essentially, that we should have. But again, that's part of evolution that we are continuously going through.
Right. This period of greed is a part of the evolution to...
I would say so. Yeah. And I would say it is exponential also. I mean, look at how we have evolved and compared to how nature has evolved, you know, from all these different diversities. But for us, within 200,000 years, we have come to a point that we can impact our environment effectively.
Oh, yeah.
Very effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not only the dinosaur, we're also the asteroid.
Exactly. Yeah. And we can be the solution ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But the point that I forgot or I couldn't remember that I remember now is that I mentioned it in the last podcast also that I think the two components are communication. We need to communicate with each other. So we know when we're stepping on each other's toes and that we also care about that, but also being able to supply chain, being able to share resources around the world easily. That's another component because probably in the evolution of humanity that one of the things that creates greed is wanting what other people have because they have more, they have better stuff in, you know, wanting that. So if there's a stronger supply chain that to be able to share goods, that would help as well. That's what
without anybody else's, you know, hindrance. Yeah.
Hopefully.
You could have effective supply chain, but some, you know, it can get interrupted.
That's true. That's true. Okay. Well, thanks for talking to me. I think we're
absolutely. I enjoyed it very much.
to stop being social animals and for me rest a little and reflect as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I enjoyed it very much, Jay. Thank you for the opportunity again.
The True Democracy Global podcast mission is to explore topics related to democracy and systems authority, as well as the technologies that support them. We cast a wide net, very wide, as you can see from my conversation here with Saeed, to bring information from a variety of sources with the intention of shedding light in every corner and illuminating a broad and deep understanding of the systems that exist past and present. With this understanding, we refined our nonprofit mission, which supports our vision to build trust, encourage constructive collaboration, and provide the avenue for the authenticity of and secure storage of information. Please visit truedemocracy.global for more information.